Hello, welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I'm your host, Jason Napolitano, and on the line we have Mr. Chris Sheridan. What's going on, Chris? How are you tonight?
Fireworks, for some reason, are going on. I don't know what occasion that might be, but who knows? This is Los Angeles, and
anything
you,
could be.
You just don't need an excuse for anything, I don't think, anymore.
I guess not, you know.
Well, that's maybe enough.
Let's have a LA, dude. Let's do this. Let's have a celebration since the fires just died out. Let's light off some fireworks.
How about that? There you go. After weeks of a bobcat fire.
All right.
No, don't set up fireworks. Are you kidding me?
No, they're putting up fireworks for you. That's gonna set you off.
There's nothing left to burn though.
There you go.
At least not around here.
that's the upside to the whole thing. All right. Perfect. There you go. Well, thank you for being here each week. Appreciate you. And we got a great show this week. So thank you also to our listeners who are supporting us. We appreciate you guys. If you would like to support the Cosmic Eye Show, you can do so at anchor.fm/Cosmic Eye. So thank you again for showing up to our Sunday show that we do each week. This is our little longer show. Oftentimes we discuss Manly Hall, as you know, if you've listened to the show before. And so this week we have a real treat. We're going to be looking at Manly Hall's First Principles of Philosophy. So this is a book that's set up very much like a series of lessons, because it was actually a series of lessons. So it's a very nice, concise overview of these different areas of philosophy, which we will talk about in a moment. I think you're going to greatly enjoy this one, though. It is a very good, systematic introduction to philosophy. And, you know, Manly Hall really was all about sharing philosophy. And I think sometimes, you know, we're going to get into this again after we start talking more about it. Manly Hall was a great advocate of becoming a philosopher and using philosophy to sort of transcend our normal human condition. And so it has quite a different connotation than I think of what most people think of as philosophy today. So we'll go into more details about that in a moment. Again, thank you for joining us. So if you want to get more information about us, you can check us out at cosmiceye.org. I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, and that is on Amazon. Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky, also on Amazon. So either of those books are great. Mine's, of course, Introduction to Meditation. Chris's is a story about his life and about his plane crash and spiritual experience before plane crash and other interesting details and so on. So I highly recommend both of our books. If you are interested and would like to support us, please check those out. All right, Chris, let us jump into this. There's all our little pitches are out of the way. We're moving on to the meat of the sandwich. As it
now we're pitching philosophy.
Now we're pitching
Step philosophy. Right up. You want some philosophy here.
Huh? How would you like a heaping helping of philosophy, right? So let's start with that first, the idea of philosophy. So let's kind of clear up this philosophy and what it is, what it means to Manly Hall, what it means to the ancients, really, as opposed to the more modern interpretation of that idea of philosophy. I'm sure a lot of people get the idea that philosophy is people on YouTube arguing about different, you know, abstract theories. You know, it has a lot of connotations and connections to academia these days, and different departments of philosophy obviously exist in the academic world. To the nth degree, they break down and argue about the semantic issues of things and the structure of knowledge and all these different things, and how it even overlaps into neuroscience and consciousness studies and so on. But when you look at philosophy in the way that Manly Hall is using the term philosophy, it's much different. And I'll just read this really quickly because it really kind of sums it up. This is from First Principles of Philosophy, of course, which we're discussing on page 10. The word philosophy was first used by Pythagoras, or Pythagoras more correctly, the greatest of the Grecian initiates, who is accredited with having created the term. The word itself means friendship for or love of wisdom. Love of wisdom. A philosopher, then, is one who loves wisdom, whose life is devoted to the discovery and application of truth. the discovery and application of truth. So discovery and application, of course, are two themes that Manly Hall talks about quite a bit, right, Chris?
Well, in other lectures, he even describes philosophy as a two-step process. Discovery and utility. Like a lot of us stop at aha. It's like, wow, it blows my mind. Yeah, I just found out that we're all connected. And the sea of consciousness and ether and, you know, or some trip you have. Or reading some great book in science. I mean, it's amazing to look at the stars and you can just get, wow, blown away by nature and different things. But then it's like, okay, that's half of it. That's the first step. The second step is the utility. If this is so aha, this is so wonderful, this is so wise, if you're a lover of wisdom, if you love it so much, you know, why don't you do it? The discovery is very important because a lot of self-discovery happens in the process of seeking for wisdom, but the true wisdom really happens when you apply it. And I think this is the distinction, you know, you're talking about is different than what a lot of people think, arguing about stuff you can't prove.
Sure.
Or is this using the wisdom of all the great thinkers of all the ages and cultures and history and bringing that together in your life now and drawing from that, use it as a guide and a process of living your life. That's the other half. It's like getting the food. Well, now you have to eat it or you're not going to get the nutritional value.
Exactly.
And that's really where Manly Hall is, his center is. And he presumes that's, you know, where you are or the reader and make sure that that's what we're talking about. It's not, you know, up in the air speculation on metaphysical, you know, perhaps. And maybe,
well, I mean, that part of it's, yeah, right.
Oh,
that
sure. You have to expand your mind. Definitely. Right. But we're looking at a whole system of different departments. Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's one of them, but logic and reason, you know, are in there as well. So,
sure.
But he just, I think he underscored the importance that, you know, maybe this was lacking. And this book was written in the 30s during the Depression. You know,
yeah.
Talking about these uncertain times. And
exactly.
That's when people turn to philosophy. So if you want to talk about, you know, why philosophy and why now?
Yeah, exactly. Let me say one more thing really quickly before we get into that, though. This discovery and utility that you just mentioned, he mentions that throughout all of his work. He mentions that very, very specifically in the Secret Teachings, and he talks about in the introduction to that, which we talked about before, which is our very first podcast that we did. One of the most important things about the Secret Teachings that he points out in some of his other work, in the book itself as well, though, he talks about really how each one of those chapters is just a variation on this idea that I'm going to tell you here right now. But it's the same idea extended out. It's, you know, basically discovering utility. So he says on 13, first of all, I'd like to read this first one. He says, philosophy is the perfect science and the science of perfection. The perfect science and the science of perfection. So he's getting into the same idea. The perfect science is the understanding. And then the science of perfection is the application. And that's where he was very clear about not just what he would call in some places wool gathering, metaphysical wool gathering. He used that term many times. I've seen him say that. And things like that, where you're just kind of going over these abstract ideas. Like, it was very important for him to stress the practicality of this work and how it applies, which is what you were just talking about a moment ago, and we'll get into. But this idea of this discovering utility is really nailed down here on page 13, where he says, more or less he's talking about the purpose of philosophy. He says, it has as its first work the elevation of the human intellect to a realization of the divine plan, a realization of the divine plan. Secondly, it has as its final consummation the elevation of man to absolute union with universal wisdom. That's the discovery and the utility. So it would be like the relative and the absolute in essence. And so what he's saying is that you've got to have an understanding, and then you've got to realize that in this understanding, you have to become one with this universal truth in essence, the universal wisdom. There's a union that has to happen. And that's the application. It's that you put it to use in your life. And not only do you understand it, but you live it. You are it. you know, you understand that there's no separation between you and anyone else, and you actually operate that way. There's a difference between knowing something and doing something about it. So let's get back to the idea. It's 1935 when this book was written. It's the height of the Great Depression. It's before we've entered World War II. World War II is coming. What he's got here, though, is this situation where people are pretty depressed and times are hard. And he's pointing out that during this time is when people finally do get back to philosophy because they need it so much. He said and he's talking about the times then when he wrote this, adversity becoming general, sober thinking came into fashion. When our systems fail us, we learn to depend upon ourselves for security and well-being. It's been demonstrated throughout history that learning is restored in trying times, ignored during prosperous interludes. And, you know, how true that is, right? I mean, we're not really striving for wisdom and knowledge when we're in the middle of enjoying ourselves in prosperous and, you know, materialistic times when things are going well. And that's why I think right now, you know, it's particularly a great time to study this material because a lot of people are having challenges in their lives. A lot of people are stuck at home. A lot of people are not working right now. And so it's a great time to really get back in touch with the ancient wisdom and the universal truths so that you can begin to kind of put your life back in order if things have kind of gotten into a bad way, as it were, to sort of get yourself out of that using these principles. And that's really what this is about. It's about creating a better life for yourself. It's about creating a more harmonious world, starting with you, and then it radiates outward, because he does talk about how on the next page, a man is what he thinks. His mental attitude is the key to his code of action, and civilization is fundamentally a code of action. So it begins with the individual, but then it spreads out into the civilization. So our thinking really does make a great difference. And then he points out how, according to Cicero, the purpose of civilization is to bring the human family to an enlightened and cooperative state. And that's another one of these purposes of philosophy. It's to bring us to an enlightened and cooperative state, right?
Well, for the ancients, the ancient Greeks, and even going beforehand and times, you know, since in between, philosophy was more than just, you know, thinking about things, thinking with others about things. It was even beyond your own personal life. It was a philosophic society, or the philosopher king, that a king in a kingdom would rule its people and subjects with the wisdom of a philosopher. Still might be a monarch, but, you know, having that philosophic outlet or outlook. So philosophy, you know, for a lot of these people was an underpinning of civilization.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Great
point. Well, it was daily life. And that's why, again, to get back to, and we can't underscore it enough, is that this is about living. This is about how to live your life. This is a plan. It's like the ultimate self-help system is a living, breathing philosophy.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, obviously, we always encourage the reading of these different books, and, you know, for you to purchase these Manly Hall works, because they're invaluable, you know, to have in your library. This one in particular, though, and I say this, I think, a lot, but I really, you know, really mean this one with this one. First Principles of Philosophy is a must have, you know, for someone who is trying to improve their life through the ancient wisdom. It is so practical and so clear, so understandable and systematic and so well written that, you know, it's just such a great tool. You know, and Manly Hall's work oftentimes is a lot. I don't want to say it's abstract, but it's a lot. You know, he's got a lot of great, you know, mythological and symbolic ideas and, you know, beautiful stories and, you know, different references and images and so on. This one, though, because he set it up to be a class, more or less, it's set up very much like in a sort of an outlined form with a very clear systematic approach to how you do this, why you do this, what's important about it, how to live the philosophic life, like you talked about. And really this, in terms of approaching a lot of his other work, is a way in where it provides this systematic framework, and he even talks about this in the introduction, to where it gives you an understanding of each of these abstract departments, which we're going to get into, of philosophy, so that you can categorize and understand experiences and knowledge in a different way. I would almost call it like a meta philosophy in a way. Would you say that was kind of appropriate? A meta program or a meta structure for philosophy, in essence, showing.
Yes, and these branches or departments, as he called them,
they're departments.
They're all aspects of the same thing, although they can be separated out enough to talk about them individually. But they are all part of this, together system where they all work together, and you need all of them. So as we go through these, we'll recognize, I think, most of them. But
yeah, exactly.
But it's nice to have a framework, like you're saying, to look at yourself and things that come up. You go, oh, well, maybe this is something I need to turn up my aesthetic branch, or like a department store. Maybe I need to, be in this part of the store because I need these things in my life or in my room.
Sure.
Nutritionally, you want to. A painting in your hallway or something to, brighten the day.
Exactly. Yeah. And, he makes this interesting distinction, speaking of the different departments. So he lays it out in the book, and he talks first about the first six branches. These are basically different schools of thought and philosophy, branches of philosophy.
Yeah, run through them.
I will run through them, but I want to make this point too, that he talks about six of them. And then he adds a seventh. So six of these, the first six of these, are what you might call the academic or exoteric version, which he calls it, in this system. And the seventh that he adds is strictly studied in the esoteric world. So you're not going to find this in academic philosophy in the universities. All right. So the seven branches of philosophy then are metaphysics. That's the first one. The second one's logic. The third, ethics. The fourth is psychology. The fifth is epistemology. The sixth is aesthetics. And then the seventh, as I talked about, is called theurgy. That's a very interesting branch. And we'll spend some time on that as we go through each of these. Now, obviously, the show is, usually about 50 minutes or an hour. So we're not going to be able to go deeply into all of these, but we're going to do an overview, and we'll dive into each of these a little bit, but hopefully we'll be able to do more work on this stuff, and we'll let you know about that from this particular book. And again, I highly encourage the purchase of this book, because I think you'll get a lot out of it. So what Manly Hall says about these different branches is he likens them to a ladder of philosophy with seven rungs, a ladder of philosophy. So it's in a way, it's an interesting ladder, because when you start with metaphysics, you're starting with really the highest, most sort of abstract, in a sense, ideas. And yet you're working from those principles. And this is where, this approach would be more in line with the ancient mind than today's modern approach in philosophy. You start with the sort of end in mind, the invisible world, the spiritual world, and you kind of work your way back. But it's interesting because this is his branches are sort of a circle, because you go from metaphysics to logic, which is pretty understandable, science and reasonableness and ethics. And then you go to psychology, epistemology, and aesthetics. And then you go to theurgy, and you're back to where you started, because theurgy is this idea of the blessed magic, basically. It's an idea of divine work. Theurgy is actually is the terminology they use a lot in ceremonial magic today, especially of the Kabbalistic kind. Modern Kabbalistic magic is generally known as theurgy. So it's this sort of wonder-working, transformational thing where you're really invoking the spirit of God within yourself and creating that within yourself and becoming this sort of more divine individual, right? But see, you can see how that leads in a circular way, in a sense. But it is a ladder. It is a ladder also, at the same time that you're working your way up. But again, He starts with this foundation, and the foundation is in metaphysics. Talk a little bit about metaphysics, and then we'll kind of go back and forth with it.
Okay. Well, to start with, I think he chose metaphysics because it kind of contains a lot of the other ones in it. It's a broad brush, but it's also distinguish between physics, and that's the things in the visible, physical world that you can observe. Metaphysics is concerned with what's behind those things, what's the original nature. Yes, you might see gravity. You can see the effects of gravity, but what's gravity? What's, where does that go? So it's the things that you can't see, really touch or feel, although you can experience the effects of them greatly in your life. So I think that's the distinction with metaphysics. It's more beyond physics, invisible compared to the visible, but like gravity, a lot of invisible forces are extremely powerful, especially our thoughts. So yep. He goes through, he actually even breaks down metaphysics into seven, elements. One is the nature of being. What does it mean to be? What is the nature of God, which is unknowable? He goes on to explain it's unknowable, but it's neat to ponder. What is the nature of knowledge? What is it to know? What is truth? What is the nature of energy? And then he goes to the nature of creation, which is energy directed towards something. You're going to make something. And the last one is the nature of divine and human relationships. That's our place in the divine plan, where your personal goal and what God has in mind for you really become the same thing. And again, like you're saying, that's the goal of this whole philosophic life.
Not only that, it's the goal, and then it's the foundation, which is quite a bit different. So this is where we, when we talk about the ancient wisdom, this is one of the things that makes it different from modern thought. Is the ancient wisdom, the metaphysical portion of it are the universal truths that you're basing your life on. And they're invisible truths, they're spiritual truths, they're universal truths. In our sort of scientific world today, they'd be known as sort of unprovable in a sense, because there's no real way to investigate some of these questions, which is why they're in the department of philosophy and not in science. But the point is that, he's basing these ideas on, the greatest thinkers of, throughout the years, thousands of years of philosophers. And he's, condensing down this information, to these principles and sort of laying out an archetypal structure, which you can form a foundation. Why you're doing this and why it's important to look at metaphysics first is because you have to, it's looking at that last one, nature of divine and human relationships. In the ancient world and in many people's minds even today, our place is in an order of, and there's order and meaning to our lives. This is a different sort of idea than, modern science would have us believe, where, there's this sort of blind force called evolution, and there's this kind of happenstance thing that happened where, life just exists and, came out of the Big Bang, and it's sort of a happy accident that, that we exist. The ancient mind was not about that at all. There's purpose and there's unfolding and there's an evolution. There is evolutionary process, but it begins in these invisible realms and it ends in this material existence, and then I shouldn't say it ends, it stops over in this material existence, and then it ends up cycling back into that spiritual world again, and then it goes round and round, because most of these ancient ideas, specifically Neoplatonic ideas, had an element of reincarnation to them. So there's a certain chain of being going on, there's and existence in the material world is only one sort of phase of that. Right. So that's why I think he's starting with metaphysics, because that's where they did in the ancient world. They started with metaphysics. So here's some universal principles to guide your life by. There is order, there is structure, there is purpose. You start with that premise, and then you work through these other divisions. So do you have anything else to add to the idea of metaphysics, or should we move on to logic before we get too deep into this? I mean, because, you know, we can't.
Yeah, no, we can do hours on metaphysics.
Yeah, so, but do you have anything else you think?
Well, just for one example, two of the sub departments of metaphysics, the nature of knowledge and the nature of truth, mainly Hall made a great analogy with these two, that knowledge could be the more fragmented, all the things that you know about this, you know about that, or even the things you personally know. But then truth, with a capital T, is this one reality that's behind all knowledge. And the analogy he uses is that this truth, this one reality, is akin to white light. But then when white light, this white light of truth, if you will, when the white light passes through a prism, it's broken down into its many colors and all its many forms. And that would be knowledge. Those would be all the different things that you might know. So they're related to each other. And he hints, and it goes through all this, that there is a larger or something behind everything.
Yeah.
You know, that there's a substratum or something, or a common essence, or the one story that determines all stories, and that's a recurring theme. So, and that, you know, comes up in metaphysics, but yeah, that's about all I have. And I like how he just goes straight into logic right after that. It's like the whole other side of the coin.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. You go from this very sort of abstract realm, in essence, abstract, not in the sense that it's not applicable and that it's not true, but abstract in the sense that, you know, it's lofty. You know, and it's grand, these theories, but at the same time, they are knowable and understandable, and they are even logical. And that's, you know, again, that's the difference between, I think, the ancient mind and the modern mind, is it was grounded in these metaphysical understandings and the idea that there actually is a universal truth. And then there's these sort of refracted rays of light coming through this prism that makes up the relative world that we live in, and all the different, you know, the 10,000 things, as they say in the Tao, you know, but they all come from that one. But so moving along, though, logic then is the next department on this ladder of philosophy. And, you know, most people are familiar with some of the ideas of logic, of course. But basically, he kind of points out how this is the doctrine of reasonableness, and notes how science comes from a lot of these logical ideas. And the sort of scientific method and so on derived from these ideas. So Aristotle was a huge influence in this particular department of philosophy, obviously.
And Bacon, the father of modern science.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Also, you know, used a lot of logic in his work.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting how this follows metaphysics. One of the ideas that he notes really about logic, too, is that, you know, it's a sort of process by which we order our mental processes, the mental process by which we live. And we can establish then a code of living. And you can, you know, we talked about that earlier at the beginning, how this code, you know, plays into the idea of civilization and so on, how our individual codes and our characters play into the larger codes of civilization and so on. But then this logic helps us develop that character, helps us live consistently with the values that we've investigated. And we do that through a systematic way of using logic to pinpoint what our beliefs and our values and our understandings are, and then live those things out. But again, those are informed by these metaphysical truths that we're building our foundation on. We're building our foundation on that. Now, some of these areas then in logic or analogy, which is a sort of a comparative idea, inductive reasoning, induction, and that goes from particulars to universals. Or deduction, which it goes from the superior, or the universal, to the inferior, the particular, the general to the specific is another way of looking at that. So there's different ways of thinking. And then, and you pointed out these, how these apply to those different areas. And this is an interesting thing. So do you want to talk a little bit about this, about the PRS thing and
how those letters philosophy have a letter? Religion and Science, PRS, Philosophical Research Society, Mr. Hall's foundation and center that he started in the 30s, about around this time, actually, 35. But he broke down these three branches or instruments of logic, I think a tribute to Aristotle, like you were saying. An analogy, this comparison, well, this is a certain way, and this other thing is kind of like that thing. So then you can reason that this thing is a certain way. I think he even had some very specific examples using that. But that induction, if you see something particular and then you can make a broader assumption out of it, that's closer to the scientific way of thinking. And then deduction is when you see the big picture and then you apply that to, and therefore with the individual or very specific or particular application that you can deduce from that, from the larger to the smaller. All work. They're all great ways of thinking.
Well, and that's analogous.
They're all practical.
That's analogous to religion. So analogy is philosophy, induction would be science, and then the deduction would be religion, which is interesting. So he breaks those ideas down into that, doesn't he?
Yeah, instruments of logic. I like how he put that.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So that kind of, you know, in a quick nutshell, is some of the ideas of logic. Obviously, we could go into greater detail with that, but you know, we don't have a huge amount of time, so we're going to move on to ethics. So this is our third rung in the ladder of philosophy. So it's metaphysics, logic, ethics. Ethics is, you know, people have a pretty good understanding of what that is. I don't know so much that we study it anymore, but I think that was more of an area of study in the past. I think there's a lot of debate anymore about whether or not ethics or morality, you know, can even really be kind of agreed upon, since, you know, they've turned most academic thought into this idea of subjective reality and relativism and so on, which says basically like, well, whatever anyone thinks is okay, and I don't have any right to impose myself on anyone else, which there is some logic and some truth to that, to be sure. But again, the ancient mind wouldn't be thinking that. The ancient mind would start from a metaphysical point of view, and they would say, well, there's universal truths, and these are obvious, and these are to be followed, and this is how we do it. They didn't necessarily agree on the specifics always about how those would unfold, but there was definitely agreement about, you know, the purpose of life and the God, about God and the gods and the energies and powers and the different, you know, structure of the universe and so on to a pretty great degree, at least in the Near East. But ethics has become a kind of area that really isn't delved into as much as it used to be, but it's an important area. Of course, it deals with codes of conduct, morality, character, and our own actions, you know, how that affects other people and so on. A lot of the teachings of Jesus, especially in the Beatitudes and in Sermon on the Mount, deal with ethics. Christianity is a very ethics-oriented religion in general. So is Judaism. Ethics and law make up a great deal of it, as is Islam. And they all come from, you know, the same branch of Judaism, that, or the trunk, really, we should call it. There are branches on the trunk of Judaism, in a sense. So, you know, so we can see why that would be. But ethics was a very important area in the ancient world, certainly in Greece, certainly in Rome, certainly in the ancient Near East. And so it's one to really look at. It's one of these things sometimes that we don't really think about until we're put into situations where we feel like there is some kind of an issue. But this is where Manly Hall, you know, he really stresses the idea that you have to think this stuff out, and you've got to use logic to sort of come up with a code of conduct for yourself that you're that you're comfortable with, and then, you know, follow that and have integrity. I mean, you have this kind of what, you know, what often is called today situational ethics, where it's like, that really means, you know, whatever's best for me and whatever is easiest, that's what I do in that situation. And a philosopher would not live life like that. A philosopher has ideas that are grounded in you know, ethical and moral responsibility, has made decisions and tries to live with integrity according to those ideas, right?
That's a different thing. Even a warring tribe or nation, the knight in medieval times, or say the samurai, even though they're out there doing battle and ostensibly to, you know, harm another person, they do that ethically. And we hear now about, you know, ethically raised food sources, or you buy a shoe and then the company donates a shoe to somebody who doesn't have one. And these, you know, these can be very attractive now. Another thing the ancients would do, philosophers, is they would allow the dialogue, even if they disagreed with the point of view or the point the other person was trying to make, they honored the person's right to speak that. And that's an ethical consideration. And I guess a final thought is the science a lot of times is devoid of ethics, or it's vague where it comes in. It's science would ask, you know, can we do this? And ethics might ask, well, should we do this? Like,
exactly.
Can we build an atomic bomb? It's like, well, should we?
true.
You know, which, and it tempers things, because science can be so heartless sometimes.
Yeah.
And it tempers, like, not only can we do this or how can we do this, it's like, why and should we and in what way? So it's a balancing force. That's why these are all connected and we need all of them. And I like that we're going through them in order.
Yeah,
because each one brings something else, another quality to whatever it is you're thinking about or trying to do, or your personal relationships, or where, anywhere in your life where philosophy applies, which is essentially everywhere.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're right. Ethics deals with, should we do this? What are the results of these actions? How will those play out and affect others? And so on. And that's why, you know, science wouldn't even try to ask those questions. It's not equipped to deal with them. And this is why, you know, this is why science can be such a dangerous force at times. And when it's not tempered with all these different areas of learning, it can go off the rails, you know, and you get all this crazy genetic engineering and chemical weapons and, you know, trying to crossbreed different animals and, you know, human life and all these crazy things that, you know, you have to ask these questions, like, should we be messing around with certain things? Should we be messing around with DNA? Should we be, you know, modifying nature? Those are questions that have to be asked, you know? And looking at the consequences of those actions and thinking about all the people involved and all the animals and all the, you know, and nature in general, the earth itself as well. Those are questions that have to be looked at. And that's the Department of Ethics that would answer those questions. All right. So we're moving on to psychology now, the science of the soul, mental phenomena. This is our 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 4th rung on the ladder. You know, everyone's pretty aware of psychology today. You know, we see so much psychological stuff in the news and on social media. And, you know, a lot of people think like psychology is self-care and a lot of these sort of pithy little sort of, you know, hashtag oriented phrases that people come up with that they think that's psychology. But psychology is much deeper than that. It's, as I said, the science of the soul. You know, psychology, psyche is the soul. That's the study of the soul, in essense.
Well, it used to be.
It used to be.
That's where Hall makes the distinction. Yeah, the ancient was more soul-based, where it was the art of psychology and your connection between, you know, spirit and your body. Whereas the modern, it shifted more towards the mind-based, you know, aspects of your mind and thoughts.
Yeah.
And we'll just think better thoughts and you'll have a, you know, change your mind, change the world. The mind is part of the soul. I think this soul-based, and in some branches like archetypal psychology or Jungian, as it were, that have incorporate more of the soul into the formula for psychology than some other ones.
Well, Jung's, I would say it's based primarily on that, and that's why it's not a very popular psychology today, except amongst certain individuals. But I'd go even further than this, you know, and this was Manly Hall's day when he was writing this modern, you know, the modern idea is mind-based. It's not even mind-based anymore. It's now brain-based. It's cognitive. Yeah, it's like this cognitive and behavioralist model now that's probably most prevalent in psychiatry and psychology today, which is why there's so much pharmaceutical involvement with psychology and psychiatry today. I mean, psychologists can't prescribe, but they certainly will send you to a doctor to get the prescriptions and so on. And, you know, and that's the difference. It's like this, the ancients and Jung himself, following these ancient traditions also, you know, they start from a different premise, and that premise is there's a soul, and that premise is that soul is connected to spirit, and that spirit is connected to the infinite. You know, and there may be different levels to that, and there may be disagreements about it, but in the end, one way or another, there's a soul, which is a more sort of spiritually oriented idea that is connected to something beyond that in some way or another. There's various ways of looking at that, but that's the difference between in a lot of ways between the modern and the ancient version of that. But you're right. I mean, that mind-based thing. But even today, we've gone so much further to brain-based. You know, it's all these ideas of neuroscience and all these different things, which are there's some definitely valuable contributions to all that. I'm not knocking those things when I say that. But without the idea of soul and without the idea of some sort of ethics, logic, and metaphysics behind that, we go off in really dangerous directions, thinking that the body and the brain are just machines. That just need tuning up with the right drug or the right, behavioral treatments or something like that. I think it leaves out a great deal of what makes us human, and the soul is the factor in that really makes a great difference. You know, recognizing that there is a soul and giving it some kind of weight in your life. And that's what Jung was really saying, is there's this inner life that's going on that involves a soul. And of course, this outer life that's very important as well, but you have to put the two in accord with each other. And that's, again, that's the same thing Manly Hall is talking about. You know, it's the inner and the outer, the upper and the lower, the as above, so below. Same ideas, right? Same ideas. So that's a more ancient approach to psychology. So move on now to epistemology as we're kind of getting into this thing. This one deals more with the nature of knowledge. You want to talk about this one?
Okay. Ontology. Is, I think, going back to where we're talking about the nature of being. That's what is. And epistemology is how do we know things? How is it that we know this is a thing? So ontology is more, what is, and this is how is it that we know that? So it's the nature of knowledge, how we know things, and also how we learn things, and what value is it? It's not just the content or the component of knowledge. It's, what is its value? And there's even the, I guess it's a debate, I'm not sure, but a distinction sometimes made with education, and it does come from the word meaning to draw out, educo, is the role or the goal to draw out what's already in there? Or is there a blank slate that I'm going to educate this knowledge on top of? And that's something that epistemology covers as well. You know, how is it that we learn things? Do we come knowing things and then we remember? Or do we come knowing nothing and then we have to, whether it's nurture or nature, we have to have some, imprint. And you could say both are true, but again, how we learn things, how we know things, sometimes it comes from a really mysterious place. Yeah. But if you're working as a philosopher, that's okay. That's not uncomfortable.
Sure. Well, in the ancient, we know the ancient view of this is that, you know, there is no such thing as a blank slate, because there you're coming in with certain invisible potentials, let's call them. In most ancient systems, there was some thought of either reincarnation or some sort of, you know, previous life experience or something coming from the gods along with you, trailing clouds of glory, as Carlyle said. There's some sort of ideal that's within you. You know, this blank slate idea is a pretty modern idea. It doesn't exist in most of the ancient ideas and ancient cultures. Plato's idea was that learning is remembering. You talked a little bit about that, the differences between these ages. It's not to say that that's, you know, has to be taken as an absolute truth, but these ancient ideas were that, and if you're interested in learning the ancient wisdom believed that there was a sort of archetypal template already existing within one, and then things were activated and remembered here. Plato's ideas from Socrates was, I think, that before we come into existence, there's sort of a place where, you know, the prior life, you know, leaves off. The soul is ready to sort of reincarnate. This is, again, I think, a more Pythagorean idea as well. But there's a sort of time where there's a forgetfulness that occurs, and you call it the rivers of Lethe, I believe. Where you drink from the river of Lethe, and you forget everything, and then you come into this existence. But there is, even though you consciously forget it, there's imprints of that stuff, which would explain different particulars, people's propensities or geniuses that they come in with. And we talked a little bit about that on the show on reincarnation. If you want to check that out back, you can check that show out. It was a few podcasts ago that we did on reincarnation. But some of those ideas are involved with that. And this is in that area of epistemology, the nature of knowledge, how we know things, how we learn things. Do we draw them out or do we put stuff in? You know, and I think, the modern view is the kid's a blank slate and we just need to shove a bunch of information into the kid's head and then they'll know and they'll become a valuable member of society. And it's kind of think to yourself, well, what's the difference, whether or not I believe one or the other thing? In my mind, and this is just my opinion, but it's a pretty great difference to think that there's something already there that's being awakened and enlivened. And, you know, this is just a one-shot deal and a blank slate and I can write anything I want on it. And Jung felt very strongly that we came in with I don't want to call it programming, but propensities, I guess. And, you know, he'd call it some archetypes or activated sort of complexes or archetypes or whatever, that already exist within us, and that the child's children are very different, even as babies. And I think anyone who's grown up around children and watched children grow and watched babies can see that these individuals are not a blank slate most of the time. You can see that there's propensities there. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. I see it every day. I'm around it. And it's like, where does this stuff come from? Like, nobody in this house would have done that.
Right? That's what I'm saying. Like, so,
and the great thing about it, I'm glad you brought that up, because the great thing about it is it holds out that there's an individual, that every single one of us has an individual style or a gift or soul's journey or destiny that is our own. There's universal commonalities, but that each one of us has our own way of looking at things and going through life. And I like that. So this one size fits all doesn't always work. And it's not really a great approach. You have to at least take into account the individuals, because people might have different ways of looking at things. And so they may come to the correct answer through a different path. So that's why I think in an educational system, to put emphasis on the individual, at least consider that individuals' needs are different. You might help somebody find something in a different way.
Good point. Yeah.
You know what I mean? They might find a different path, and they may still get to the right answer that you're trying to, you know, get across, or the point. But we may have different ways of moving through our learning or relearning or remembering, if it is. and experience. So I'm glad you brought that out. Yeah, that's a, yeah, that's a really good point. A little off topic, but it's part of that idea. How, right? How
so,
we know.
All right, so moving on to aesthetics, and we'll go through these last two pretty quickly. But again, like I said, I urge you to check out this book, First Principles of Philosophy, and read deeper into each of these chapters. And like I said, we're probably going to go much deeper into each one of these. But for now, this is an overview. So the next one is aesthetics. So this is the sixth rung on our ladder, our philosophical ladder. We started with metaphysics, went to logic, ethics, psychology. We just did epistemology. Now we're into aesthetics. And this deals with the arts, the idea of beauty, Plato's idea of the one, the beautiful, and the good. And this also deals with how beauty and beautiful things affect us, their effects on us, and the harmony and so on. And of course, this is the realm of the arts, which Manly Hall talked about as being a universal medicine. So this is an area that I would argue today, again, much like ethics, many of these areas are kind of, I would say we're pretty strong with logic, with our scientific thinking. Metaphysics is probably pretty weak in most of us. Ethics is not awful. I mean, they do come to talk about things. In psychology, of course, we talk about, but in a different way. But this aesthetics is really one of these things where I would argue we're not very aesthetic anymore. We certainly have a lot of entertainment and a lot of media and a lot of images around us at all times. I don't know how aesthetically appealing or important they are. You know, and I suppose that's a subjective thing, you know, what people find beautiful. But I don't know that there's a lot of thought put into these ideas. It's, I think, our most of our medias and most of our arts these days, you know, including, you know, film and television shows and music and, you know, even our, you know, visual arts, you know, unfortunately, they're pretty commercial. You know, even in the fine art market, if you look at what's being produced today by most artists, there are some beautiful artists, don't get me wrong, some very talented artists out there. But what sells often commercially, especially for high dollar amounts at, you know, at auction at Christie's and so on, is often just this, you know, I'm not trying to judge it, but it's very poppy, postmodern artwork that's pretty simple and oftentimes very sort of street oriented or sort of variations on Warhol or variations on Lichtenstein or variations on, you know, pop artists from the 50s and 60s and so on. That, you know, it's just, there's not a lot to it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you know, beautiful art should compel or impel something within you, release something that I want to do better and be better and do good works in this world. Yeah. I know there's the practice of feng shui where certain arrangements of different parts, like maybe where you put the doorway or the window or the parts in your room where you arrange the furniture, or maybe if you have the option of deciding where the doorway is going to be, but that it's in harmony with nature, that we're working together on this. And of course the ancients, you know, we're talking about the ancient Greeks, certainly had the golden mean, the golden ratio, the architecture, the buildings, even though they didn't really overtly see it, they were built with all these, you know, the Fibonacci sequence, all these harmonious and beautiful geometric alignments and arrangements. Didn't really have to. You could still build a temple and columns and pillars without using the golden mean. But it was put in there because it was felt that it meant something. That if this sequence, this ratio appears again and again in nature, well, why not put that into our buildings? And when we go in, maybe we're, you know, more in harmony with nature than we are just putting some structure. Well,
that idea was too, I think, just like you're talking about, you know, using those different, you know, ideals and measurements and so on that they recognized in nature. You know, they put you in harmony with nature. They put you in harmony with harmony and balance. In other words, just the viewing of those artworks and so on, and those beautiful buildings and the gardens and specific proportions and beautiful, you know, natural settings and so on, was healing to the soul. And that's, you know, that's what Manly Hall says when he talks about it as a universal medicine. And again, I'm not meaning to knock, you know, the work that people are doing today when I talk about that in music and art and film and so on. It's just that it's not informed by any sort of aesthetic considerations. So the ideas of most work, not all work, again, I'm sort of generalizing popular materials. A lot of the work that we're looking at is very jarring. It's very discordant. It's very unharmonious. In fact, most of the, if you look at it, and if you think about film and media and television, I'm going to argue that most all of it is, because it's designed to elicit the most base responses within us, you know, anger, jealousy, greed, revenge, you know, covetousness and so on, you know, and I'm not trying to moralize about it, but it's certainly not inspiring us to be our best, most of it, right? And so, you know, in some ways, you know, art is supposed to hold up, obviously, discordant things as well, so we can recognize that. And certainly, you know, Greece and it had its tragedies and its plays and so on. And there was, you know, obviously, even the mythology of the gods, it's, no one was perfect. I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about the idea of, you know, harmony and proportion and beauty as being a sort of code by which one would put this artwork together. And having purpose and thinking those things through. And that's quite a bit different than just trying to create work that you think is going to be popular. Again, that is not to knock artists today. I'm sure there are many artists, I'm sure, who are very, you know, doing very heartfelt, very important work. But it's even then, it's still missing a lot of these aesthetic considerations. And that's where I think this is the kind of one of the areas where you can look at and look at some of these ideas of proportion and harmony. And like you talked about these different, you know, the Fibonacci sequences and the different ratios, golden mean, and all these different ideas to help inform your aesthetic sensibility and your the creation of your work, you know, in poetry and music and in your lyrical qualities, you know, in all of it. And I think that's one of the things that the Greeks thought that very important. I think it's very important even today, you know, and so in trying to go back and read the classics and read, you know, classic literature. And so it doesn't mean that you can't, you know, watch soap operas and watch videos of funny cats, but it means to sort of supplement that with great artworks and great literature and great poetry. That stood the test of time, great music, and understanding how that fits into the historical context and how it fits these aesthetic qualities and so on. And there can be great lessons, I think, in listening and participating in those, wouldn't you say?
Well, there is. And this aesthetic quality is something we can really do ourselves, have a large, even if we have very limited reach on what we can do with our living space. You could put things, arrange your desk a little more symmetrically, or you could, there's, you know, small things that can help balance you, help restore order, especially in a world that's full of doubt and fears and inconsistencies. If we can control our environment or, you know, our computer desktop or whatever we're doing and make it just a little bit better, or maybe then put a plant there by the window. Sometimes it's one small thing can open up a space and help, you know, connect you. It's not, again, it's like an object of veneration. It's not just the object itself, that's beautiful. It's your connection to that and what that brings up. Absolutely. That's what's, you know, really the value behind it. Then you become beauty and you become beautiful and you think beautiful thoughts.
That's a great way to put it.
Because you're surrounded by beauty.
That spills over into the way that you treat others. It spills over in the way that you feel about yourself, the way that you feel about the earth and your, you know, your place in it, and, you know, the stars and, you know, the universe and God and whatever else, right? And kind of like the whole harmonious chain of being, as we'd call it. So that's a very important area, and one that I think is highly overlooked today. It's something that this book gives you a little overview of. And I have a feeling that a lot of people, if they did read this section in the book, would want to do more investigation into this area of aesthetics, because it's a very interesting and powerful area. And it's one that moves the soul, moves the heart. You know, and most of us are affected by art in one way or another, and it's a way to understand it and go into it philosophically that gives it a deeper layer of meaning. It doesn't strip it down and, you know, try to dissect it and kill it. It, you know, it recognizes that, you know, some of this stuff is mysterious, like why a painting moves us, or why a particular piece of music moves us, why it doesn't, or why one doesn't. There's a mysterious quality to that as well. But, you know, it's interesting to kind of look at these aesthetic ideas and see how they work. All right, so we have to move on. Unfortunately, we're going to talk, and not unfortunately, but we do need to move on. It's about theurgy. I mean, it's not unfortunate that we're talking about theurgy, but we only have so much time, is my point. And again, theurgy, as I talked about at the beginning, is this idea of this divine work, of this blessed magic of the Egyptian Hermeticus. This is really a great area, and again, one that would require multiple shows to deal with, but it is involved with the idea of ceremonial magic, alchemy, Rosicrucianism. Freemasonry falls into this category, the whole idea of ritual and ceremony, more sort of formalized experiences of mystery and drama. Definitely, as I said before, ceremonial magic. And in regard to this, if anyone is interested in a very great book on ceremonial magic, modern, but then draws from the same traditions that Manly Hall talks about, and this Egyptian Hermetic tradition, and particularly Neoplatonic traditions and so on, is Israel Regardi's book, The Tree of Life, a classic in the field of ceremonial magic, Kabbalistic ceremonial magic, and one that I would highly recommend. So if you're interested in this idea of theurgy and you want to go beyond this, definitely check that book out. But again, you know, this, you know, Kabbalah falls under this category, mysticism, more the sort of experiential, almost, you'd almost call this the yoga of the West, and that is what Dionne Fortune called Kabbalah in her great book, Sacred Magic of the Kabbalah. You know, that this whole tradition is sort of the yoga of the West. Excuse me. Her book is called, her book is The Mystical Kabbalah. I'm sorry.
Well, it's the doing of it.
The magic of the Kabbalah, mystical Kabbalah. Okay.
You know, this theurgy is the practice. It's the act of living philosophically. All these, the six previous ones, you know, are brought together, and yes, you have the painting in your room and you have, you know, logical thoughts and everything. And this is now when you become the alchemist.
Yeah.
You know, you are the magician. Mm-hmm. You are the healer. You are the guru. This is where it all happens. And Hall points out that the other six, the first six, were more or less, you know, knowledge gained out there in the arts and sciences. And that this seventh one, that's what's learned within. That's what really can't be taught. But by applying all these six into your soul, using them in your daily life, it's then what do you gain from
that? That's a great point. Yeah.
You know, what do you learn from that? What comes out, this internal knowledge? But this internal knowledge just doesn't come out from, you know, nowhere. I mean, it's in the practice of being a philosopher, using these other branches, that, you know, this is the consummation. This is where they all come together in you.
Well, and this
you
too
are the
is,
philosopher.
Absolutely. And
living
then, you know, and then
the
again,
philosophy,
like you said, it's coming full circle. You know, so we started with metaphysics as a sort of first rung on this ladder, and then we end again almost like in the metaphysical world, but we're actually experiencing it. We're becoming one with it. You know, and again, this is the six steps are the discovery, and then the seventh step is really the utility. Although discovery and utility are happening throughout the whole process, you know, this is sort of the apotheosis, this theurgy portion of it, where you're becoming one with that knowledge. You're embodying it, or in, as Manly Hall put it, and you often explain as he said, ensouling it, right? Ensouling it.
Well, you've learned the notes and now you're playing the music. You've learned the steps.
That's it.
And now you're doing the dance. You know, it's a very expressive, it's the art of your life.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, excellent.
This philosophic life.
That's it. And so, you know, unfortunately, we are getting towards the end of this thing. But again, I want to recommend this book. And I'll give the title one final time. First Principles of Philosophy by Manly P. Hall. And so you can see how all these different departments of philosophy work together, how you can apply them to your life, and most importantly, how you can, you know, transform your life with the knowledge that they give you. And that's really what this is all about. And that's really what he wants to stress. And so that it's philosophy then is not some abstract concept, but it's a way of life. It's a philosophic life, isn't it?
It is. And I like what he says about it. I'll just loop around to the beginning. Philosophy overcomes doubt. It rescues men from despair. It perceives justice beneath injustice and gives vision and a certain hope. So it's really the light of the world. It may be our way out of this mess. And he makes no bones about it. He says it right there, that this is the importance of it, can transcend really all the difficulties of life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If we live so a philosophic life. Reason to study this ancient wisdom and apply it to your own life, and look for these truths that have sustained us and transformed us throughout the ages. And this is really what Manly Hall does throughout all of his work, is he's finding and condensing down these ancient ideas into practical ways that we can apply them to our own lives today. So again, highly recommend this book. Thank you again for joining us. We appreciate it. We're here each Sunday with our show, with our Cosmic Eye show. And then also on Friday, we have another version of the Cosmic Eye show, the Emmett Fox Friday show that we do, where we look at his work, Find and Use Your Inner Power. So again, please, if you can, we thank the people that are supporting us financially. We really appreciate you guys. Thank you so much. If you can and you're not, please support us at anchor.fm/cosmiceye and help us to bring this work to others, keep moving it forward, and check out our books. Chris is The Spirit in the Sky, and I am If You Can, Where You Can Meditate, again, both available on Amazon. Thank you again, Chris, and have a great week. Goodbye, and God bless.